program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by Ask Me Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Before I get out of bed,
coffee,
I like my coffee in the morning, cause it's oh so good for my head. I like to lie around the morning and maybe I'll get up late.
Late, late, I get up late.
I like to lie around the morning and maybe I'll get up late.
Late, late, I get up late.
I wanna do a little grind, I wanna see what we can percolate. I like a penguin, like some margarine, like a lemon and roast too. It really drives me crazy what your friends will do. I like my coffee in the morning before I get out of bed.
Coffee, coffee, I like my coffee.
I like my coffee in the morning cause it's oh so good for my head. Like Colombian roast too. It really drives me crazy what your friends would do. Coffee in the morning before I get out of bed.
Coffee, coffee, I like my coffee.
I like my coffee in the morning cause it's oh so good for my head. It really doesn't matter if I do get home real late.
That's right, we're not getting home late tonight. You are listening to Labor Radio here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland and the greater Cascadia area, and streaming live on the web at www.kboo.fm. I'd like to say hi to all those folks out there listening online. This is your host, Kevin, your friendly neighborhood letter carrier, and tonight we're going to have a great show. I have a roaster from one of Portland's finer coffee emporiums here to talk about the history of coffee, what we as consumers can do to help out the folks who produce this stuff, who manufacture it, who serve it to us, too, because let's face it, folks, coffee is the working class drug of choice, right? Everybody has coffee breaks. I work for a big company where we have 2 10-minute, quote-unquote, coffee breaks every day. So coffee has wound its way into the psyche of Americana. And here in Portland is coffee heaven, is it not? I tell you, I am continually blown away at how many little and corporate coffee shops seem to open up every week in this town. There's right now over, according to some sources, 90 coffee shops within the city of Portland. So tonight I'm going to be joined with Joel Pollack, who is here from Stumptown Coffee. He's a roaster. Joel, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you.
And after Joel's here, I'm going to have L.C. Hansen, president of the local letter carriers union, to talk about last weekend's extremely successful food drive and about how the union movement gets involved in community efforts like that and what you can do to support that. Joel, so tell us a little, let's talk a little bit about the history of coffee, because if you look on the web, if you try to do a little research on this, you tend to find this same story, and maybe you can relate that to us rather than me just read it verbatim.
Well, it's the legend of Caldy. You know, this goat herder apparently witnessed his goats being exuberant after consuming some little cherries that contain coffee beans. So
they got wired. In other words, they found a coffee bush and got wired.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, I've heard that over time.
So, but it came from Ethiopia.
Yeah, Ethiopia is the only country in the world where coffee is actually native.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It's been imported everywhere else in the world.
Everywhere else. It went to India and then quickly to Java after that.
So it jumped. Oh, so it jumped the other way across the ocean is what happened.
And also to across the Red Sea to Yemen, which they still grow coffee there in sort of a wild way, like it grows wild there.
So it's there's still somewhere on this planet wild coffee plants growing.
Yeah, there's it's not that uncommon. You know, there's all levels of cultivation for coffee. I've seen huge, massive farms, and I've seen families who have two trees. And, you know, maybe they produce half a bag, and at the end of the crop cycle, they'll go down, sell it at auction or whatever.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Cool. So tell me, how did you get into the coffee business?
I got into coffee just randomly. I was had kind of a background working in kitchens as a cook, and I was going to college at the University of Montana in Missoula. And I just saw a coffee roasting machine in the window of a business, and I was passing out resumes, so kind of randomly dropped it off because it looked kind of cool, and I had a passing interest at that time, but I didn't really know anything about it. I got hired as a barista and subsequently learned about, you know, 20 to 30 coffees, but they were all in front of me, and I kept tasting them. I was one of the things I did was choose what coffee would have brewed at that time, and I kept tasting, and I started to realize I had a good palate. I didn't even know. So it was something I got interested in, and it was a small, you know, mom-and-pop company, and soon they needed some help with the roasting, so I kind of convinced them to teach me how to do it.
Cool, and how long ago was that?
I started in 92. I think I started roasting maybe the next year, just sort of roasting part-time, going to college, and I was also making espresso as a barista, so did all three of those things.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about making the perfect espresso, too, because a long time ago I read an article by the great Dr. Ernesto Illy, who I guess is the founder of the modern espresso movement.
He is a legend.
He's a legend.
Yes, he is.
Legend in the coffee business.
Yeah, he's they approach coffee from a very scientific point of view. They've made a lot of progress, and they've also kind of influence a lot of people's opinions on what espresso should be in an Italian family.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The article that I read about Ernesto Illy said that he won't drink coffee espresso made by anyone else.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm sure that's true.
So let's talk about the bean itself. It starts off in Ethiopia. It moves to India, jumps over to Java. From there, it's, you know, travels to where? Central and South America?
South America, I think, and just kind of fanning around everywhere.
And now it's big business. Now it's a gigantic business in this country.
It is. It's Brazil, I think, is the number one producer. Colombia is number two. And Vietnam is somewhere in there, but that was this is a very recent thing, and that was kind of funded by the World Bank. They had a huge infusion of money to sort of boost their industry, but also had some unforeseen consequences where the quality of coffee that you can produce in Vietnam, it's of a different quality. It's of kind of a lower grade than Arabica coffee, which is kind of what I'm talking about. And when you talk about espresso and Starbucks and all that, generally we're talking about the Arabica species of coffee. And Robusta coffee is kind of the lower grown and more hearty, but also a little bit more brash tasting and gives you a little bit more of a kind of a harsh buzz, if you will.
So is that what you would find in like a 2-pound can?
Or yes. You might find a blend
of
some of each, but yeah, you'd find some Robusta in there.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Everybody has their own taste in coffee, and it's just fascinating to go into any coffee shop and hear somebody order a cup.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And you are listening to Labor Radio here on KBOO. And if you'd like to join a conversation, talk about your favorite bean or your barista, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. So let's talk about the bean itself. How is that bean traded on the world market? There's a huge issue among coffee consumers, conscious coffee consumers, as in KBOO listeners, about fair trade coffee. And what does that mean? And what is fair trade coffee? What does organic coffee mean? And you're in the business. You look at these beans all the time. How do you see that issue?
Well, you either have, basically, it's a certification, just as you would certify something in an organic way. The outside organization is called Transfair, and I believe they're based in Boston. I'm not positive, but the idea is that a minimum price was paid for that coffee. So at that point, you, as a member of kind of the fair trade movement, and you have to pay some fees to Transfair, you then can sort of package your coffee as a fair trade product. So you have, when we, all of our coffee that's organic is also certified fair trade, because, you know, you find that those are different issues, but there's a relationship there. You know, it's kind of about being ethical with the way that you are consuming in the world. And the way that we've sort of approached it is that fair is kind of a concept, and it's difficult to kind of quantify a concept. It's a little bit easier to quantify organic. You know, did you use artificial or petrochemicals on that or not? Yes, no. And then you can certify. But fair is a little bit of a different thing. And so it's in a young phase. So what we're also doing is trying to sort of attach quality to that label of fair price being paid. So if we pay a high price for a coffee, it may not be certified fair trade, but if we know the farm and we know the farmer and we know the coffee because we've roasted it for several years and intend to do so for several years down the road, then we feel that that's a really kind of a positive way of approaching not only our business, but the way that they can approach their farm. They'll know that they have business down the road, and they'll be able to improve quality. And we're encouraging our growers to pay the workers more money to pick the coffee. And what that does is, one of the most important aspects of coffee production begins with the actual picking. Only ripe red cherries to be picked, not overripe or not underripe. And you can really taste it in a cup if you get an overripe cherry. It tastes kind of over fermenty, or a little bit like almost like a blueberry that's like way too ripe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fruity in a way that's not pleasant, whereas underripe coffee has a little bit of a metallic kind of bright, like brashiness to it. So from that point on, you know, you're approaching quality and into the processing and all the way down to the way the coffee is handled and roasted and then how it's prepared at someone's house or in an espresso cafe.
So these growers come in all shapes and sizes, I take it.
Yeah, every country has kind of maybe some trends. Like some countries you'll see large farms generally.
And where would that be? Where would you find, you know, I imagine Vietnam must be one of them that you were just talking about.
Well, you know, I don't have a lot of knowledge about coffee production in Vietnam, just because that's not a market that we participate in. But okay. I visited Brazil, and they have a tremendous amount of large farms. And the region there is called the Cerrado, and it's actually pronounced like Cerrado. And that means savanna in Portuguese, essentially. And it's a big, high kind of plain. And they figured out in the 70s, and actually Illy, they're huge buyers down in this area, that you can kind of cultivate coffee down there almost like how people are cultivating corn in Iowa. It's the most mechanized coffee production in the world, but it's also very unique because it never had trees, so it's not going to be like a shade-grown situation. But what they did is they planted coffee trees around beginning in the 70s, and the area produces tremendous amount of coffee, especially for kind of the Italian market. They produce something which is called a Brazil Natural, which is a dry processed coffee, meaning that the fruit of the bean, the coffee cherry, is actually allowed to dry and shrivel a little bit, and that absorbs some of the sugars from the coffee fruit or the pulp, and then it's kind of more mechanically removing the fruit after it's dried, so you get a different character. But some people like to use that for espresso, and it's actually kind of a Italian tradition to use that for espresso. That's not something that we use for espresso, but it's popular.
So you got the growers, and they could be anywhere from two plants to thousands of acres.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Colombia is kind of right up there. They're a huge producing country, and I visited Colombia for the first time this year and really, really opened my eyes. Colombia is a extremely diverse country. The coffee production in Colombia on a latitudinal range actually spans a further north-south range than like Central America proper, from Mexico to Panama.
It's such a huge country.
Huge country. And incredible amount of diversity in elevation of farms. So there's basically somebody harvesting coffee almost all the time in Colombia, and yet they have two main harvests. But the other fact that I learned was that the farms are actually very small in Colombia. And there's very like a whole multitude of flavor profiles, which is kind of the coffee industry way of saying different tastes that you're going to find, you know.
So are these small farms, are these people farming their own land, I take it?
They are. They're farming lots of different things, including some coffee trees.
Hillsides and mountains and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you get to those levels, you find that you have a pretty like low-tech situation, which we have found that to be a good thing. You know, we've been working with a lot of farms in Latin America, you know, Nicaragua and Honduras and you name it, lots of other countries. But the sort of lower-tech farms are using the old techniques. They're using native shade-grown trees, no artificial fertilizers or pesticides, yet they may not be certified organic. But if you go hang out at the farm, you'll see what they're doing, and it's you can taste it in the cup. And there's really no – you can't really sort of misrepresent that. If you visit the farm, you feel pretty good about it. And you would never call it organic, but, you know, sustainable production is a good thing. So
right. So you have your growers, and you're saying they have two seasons. What is, like, the prime seasons for harvesting coffee?
Well, actually, Colombia's got two seasons, but Latin America, just Central America, just really has one. And they begin harvesting around January. And, it depends on the elevation of the farm. If it's a higher elevation farm, then it takes a little more time for the sugars to mature and to get the coffees ripe and to get them out of there. But we may start seeing coffees from Guatemala around kind of, you know, March through May, but I'm still waiting on some from Guatemala.
Is it is it the kind of thing where you want to get them as fresh as you possibly can?
Well, actually, no. That's interesting. It would be, I guess, logical to think that. But what we usually find is kind of the second pass is the best, and second and third, if it has a chance to rest, it's a little bit better. Coffee can be a little bit almost effervescent and a little bit overly bright, and it needs a chance to kind of mellow out, let the sugars mature a little bit, and it loses a little bit of moisture as it rests, and the character just gradually kind of shifts. It picks up a little bit more body and sweetness, and it's a little more stable.
Now, this is pre-roasting, is what you're
saying. Yeah, this is just green coffee, and interestingly enough, the same thing is true for roasted coffee. Coffee right out of the roaster actually is a little bit two-dimensional and kind of thin, and also a little bit effervescent. It has a lot of carbon dioxide that it has to lose. And if you let it sit overnight or maybe 2-3 days, you're going to find that the coffee is a lot more sort of mellow and mature, but still sweet and vibrant. It has like whatever like sort of vibrant fruit or chocolate flavors are inherent to the coffee just based on the little microclimate that it was grown in or the variety of coffee or the way that it was cultivated and processed. You're really going to see that if it's kind of had a chance to rest at least a day. When I roast samples to make purchasing decisions or kind of evaluate quality, we always wait 24 hours. I just got done roasting samples before I came down, and we'll cup them tomorrow afternoon.
So you roast them on one day, and the next day you try them.
Yeah, generally. That's just the best way.
So from our growers, let's go back to the – so you have all these little growers, and they actually – do many of them pick their own beans, or is it so labor-intensive that you have to have a crew come and pick your beans?
It's very labor-intensive.
Yeah.
Basically, they hire people from usually nearby towns.
Uh-huh.
And depending on the size of the farm, I mean, if a person has just a few trees, they're going to pick their own coffee.
Right.
But if it's big enough, you know, it's a lot of by-hand labor. So you're going to definitely find, like, you know, some migrant labor.
And so there's crews that actually come through, much like picking crops anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. And it's a good time for us to travel because usually right around New Year's Day is when the people are arriving in a lot of these Latin American countries to be the pickers.
Really? So where do they come from?
They usually come from, you know, nearby towns or right. whatever. It's just, it's like you said, it's just like any other kind of agricultural industry. It's a similar kind of situation where you have people from around the areas come pick for a while, and if it's a large farm and if it's a long ways, often they'll live on the farm for some time.
So you as a grower would go in there, and as a buyer, like to go there about that time of year.
Yeah, it's great to see the coffees when they're still on the tree, because you can kind of see the health of the tree, you can see how things have been handled, and you know, there's no mistaking like a really nice, ripe, clean, red coffee cherry. They're beautiful, and when they look a certain way, you can sort of project that, yeah, everything's in line so far. If you go to a farm, the analogy that I like to make is, have you ever been to a restaurant where you can tell everyone hates to work there?
Right.
Well, if you go to a coffee farm, you can tell if it's a miserable place to be.
Is that right?
It takes about 10 minutes.
So. People have an attitude.
It's just they're not there by choice, and you know, and I haven't seen a whole lot of that, because I've traveled to people that we do business with and people that we sort of are visiting because we have a relationship with. So we don't really make blind visits to farms and say like, all right, let's check this coffee out.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're participating in a lot of these auctions, and when we participate, there's a auction program that's called Cup of Excellence, and that's actually kind of that's the name, that's the brand name of that organization. It's not in every country, but it's funded partially by USAID. And the idea is it sort of opens doors for people like us to go visit. For example, I just got back from Honduras, and somebody else from the company just recently got back from Nicaragua. When we participate in these cuppings, you're a judge in an international jury of tasters. You've got people from all around the world. You've got, you know, all around Asia, Korea, Japan. You have people from Russia, people from Spain, Australia, North America, Canada, Northern Europe. And everybody's got sort of a different idea of what they're looking for. So if you sort of crunch those numbers, they try to get at least 24 judges. If you crunch those numbers, you can really get kind of a random sample of what is the highest quality coffee coming out of that country. And then about a month after everyone gets home, they have an online auction.
So you have the growers. They grow this stuff. They tend their trees. I probably have to prune them and take care of them, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's, the more that I learn about coffee production, it's incredibly complex.
It's like an orchard, right?
Yeah.
And then any of the workers come for that little period of time, you know, that they start picking them. How long is that period for? I mean, does it last for a month or 2 months or less than that?
2 months plus, you know.
Two plus months, right.
Wow. You really have to take some passes through there, because not every cherry is ripe at the same time. So what we're really trying to sort of discourage is what you would call strip picking. You know, just basically grabbing the branch, pulling all the, if you can picture the cherries, it's almost like a cherry tree, but they're a lot tighter and closer to the twig. And sometimes you'll see like where everything gets pulled into a sack, even some leaves. And then, you know, maybe later it's sorted out, but you're going to end up with all kinds of unripe or overripe cherries, and it creates a big headache for kind of separation.
So it goes straight from the tree into a sack, and then where does it go?
It goes into what's called a depulper. It's run through kind of a grinder that is much larger than, you know, it's not actually grinding the coffee, but it's breaking the skin of that coffee cherry,
uh-huh.
and then it's being washed. It's being dropped in it's being dropped into a fermentation tank. And for about 8 to 12 hours, depending on the ambient air temperature, it'll sit and ferment. And all that does is sort of loosen up all that pulpy fruit and skin. And then it's run through some little channels and then through another final kind of a mechanism that gets the rest of the fruit off. And then that's a stage in which is called pergamino, and it needs to be dried. So generally it's dried on big patios in the sun. You'll see pictures sometimes in coffee shops.
People rake it,
yeah,
right.
That's what they're doing, is they're keeping the coffee moving so there's no like sort of moist pockets, because any mold or fermentation produces a really off cup, and that you don't get paid for off cup. I mean, every coffee has a market, and interestingly enough, it's all sold. I mean, there's all levels of quality, and even, you know, things like prison coffee. There's a home for all coffee.
Prison coffee. Yeah. Boy, that makes you think something. Yeah. Sounds like the guys at work. You are listening to Labor Radio, and this is your host, Kevin Card, and I'm here with Joel Pollack, a roaster from nearby Stumptown Coffee. And we're talking about coffee. We're talking about the working class drug of choice, what it is, how it gets to you, and how you can be a conscious coffee consumer. If you'd like to join this conversation, we're at 503-231-8187. So after it's picked, after it's cleaned out, Joel, and after it's dried, then you go on an online auction. How does that work? You've already tasted this coffee somehow. How do you know about this?
Well, we usually have somebody at those particular competitions, so I've got my cupping notes, and they have carbon copies of these forms that you fill out, and there's a category of 8 or 10 different things about the coffee that you make observations, and you have to basically attach a numerical value, which was very, very foreign to me at first, but it's a system that does work, and the reason it's nice is because it eliminates variables, so you can really evaluate coffees in an expedient fashion.
But so it's like 1 to 10 or 0 to 100, or
it's technically out of 100, but during you'll have there's some mathematical trickery that goes on, but basically you get a number, and the cutoff for their auction is a minimum score of an 84. And so that says, this is an excellent coffee. So basically what we're doing at that point is kind of finding out where the farms are who are producing really beautiful coffees, and hopefully we can go visit them and basically talk about what would it take to buy, maybe a container of coffee or more coffee than, because these auctions are kind of small lots. And we share them.
What do you mean a small lot? I'm trying to...
Oh, 10 bags of coffee, and a bag weighs about 69 kilos.
Gotcha.
So that's, 150 pounds.
Huh.
So basically, one of the first ones we did that was in the hills of northern Nicaragua near a town called the Pueblo Nuevo. And we went down there to Señor Daniel Canales, and we checked out his farm. We tasted the coffee again, and we've been buying his coffee ever since. So Cup of Excellence actually opened that door. But although we never bought a single bean of his coffee below any fair trade pricing, we would never be able to kind of label it as fair trade. And one of the reasons that is because he mills all of his own coffee. And part of the stipulation that Transfer makes for fair trade is that you have to... the coffee has to be milled at a co-op, meaning that it's shared by other farmers, which is good for small farmers, but some farmers are big enough to where they kind of want that quality control. And, there's nothing wrong with a shared mill. Not everyone does it that way.
Cool. Well, we have a caller. Caller, you have a question about coffee for Joel from Stumptown?
Yeah, hi. This is Pratik. I'm calling from Southeast Portal. Hey, excellent show. Well, this is my first time calling to enter a radio show, so that's pretty cool. It's Kebu. Hey, two comments. Well, one comment and one revelation about a coffee I know about and you guys may too. The first one is, I think, just like many other things, Joe's really, making me appreciate the art of coffee growing and everything to do with that. So thanks for that. Second comment I had was, I want to share with you guys and your listeners about a coffee. It's called the Kofi Luwak coffee. And you can find out about it at, you can look it up on the internet. This coffee actually costs about $300 to $400 a pound, and they're U.S. dollars. And what makes it unique is that there are these, in the jungles of Indonesia, there are these, some kind of monkeys that eat these, eat some kind of beans some kind of coffee beans growing out there in the forest, or it kind of grows in the wild, and their body digests some of it, but the rest of it they excrete out, and the local people go out there and pick up these excreted, whatever that thing is called, these beans, or, I don't know the exact term for it, and they actually use that to produce Kofi Luwak coffee, and it's something in their stomachs the bean going to the whole digestive system of that particular monkey gives it a unique flavor. And it's a pretty hot commodity, and people in the Western world are paying $300 a pound for it.
Have you ever had a cup of this?
No, I can't afford it, man. It's too expensive. I go to Stumptown, though. I live like two blocks from Stumptown, so it's cool.
Well, but thanks for your call. Let's ask Joel here. Joel, have you heard of this?
I sure have. I've never tasted it. It's called Kopi Luwak, and it's sort of like Kali, the goat herder, something that you hear about in the periphery quite a bit. And it's exactly like he described. I think it's a marsupial that it picks the finest ripe cherries and eats it and then excretes it, as he said. And then they gather it and do the final processing on the coffee. And I've heard it's quite expensive, and I've actually talked to people who've tasted it before, but I've never tasted it myself. And it's maybe a little in a different sort of category of things that we're dealing with. Like it's very specialized, and that's not maybe so much what we're dealing with our coffee. But it's very interesting to me, just as a coffee person. I like to taste anything unique like that I hear about. Although I'd be a little sketched out. I don't know.
I think it's fantastic that there's people who actually look for that.
You know?
I mean, are you still there, caller?
Yeah, I'm totally here.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling up. That's now, I think, you know, all of our listeners are going online right now to try.
KofiLuwak.com.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
That's great. So what we have here is, that was a great phone call. You never know what you're going to run into. You find your grower, you go out and you search your grower out, you find a good cup, you've been there, you try it out, and you bid for it online, right? You go for an online bidding process.
Yeah.
How long does that take? Is that running year-round, or when does this happen?
Well, first of all, I should clarify that this bidding process is only for that coffee that we buy on this Cup of Excellence program,
okay,
which does not represent, you know, the majority of our coffee.
Gotcha.
But what that allows us to do is kind of visit farms and negotiate directly. And then we would still use an importer and we would still use an exporter. But the way that the model has shifted is that rather than calling an importer and saying, hey, what do you have in the warehouse, you know, in Oakland? We would just pay them a price per pound to import the coffee for us. But we actually did some of the investigative work. We found the coffee. We helped separate the lots and cupped the ones that we wanted and put the container together the way we wanted it. And a container is just kind of an increment of coffee.
Right.
It represents about 270 bags.
Wow.
So things are changing for us. You know, this is all kind of a new model, and I think it works better for everyone.
Well, you know, I've always been concerned when you look at people. I remember I had my son worked for the big granddaddy of coffee companies, and he was telling me that, you know, that one of the priorities was to protect their benefits, and it was amazing how much profit they made off of one cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And I hearken back to my late stepfather, Harry, who used to say, kid, if you want to make money in this world in food, there's two things you sell, coffee and pizza. It's got the highest markup.
Well, alcohol's not bad either.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it is. Hence the microbrewery phrase.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How do you make decaf coffee? What is the difference between decaf and regular coffee?
Well, we buy decaf coffee that's already decaffeinated, and there's a number of processes that are used to decaf it. The two that we're using currently are, one is called Swiss Water Process, which I think we've probably all heard of.
Right.
And that's a brand name. It's a kind of a protected trademark. The water and the coffee, none of that's actually from Switzerland.
Right.
It's done up in Vancouver, British Columbia. And they basically soak the beans in a lot of water, and then they decaffeinate that sort of with what you would call like flavor-charged water through charcoal filters, and then reintroduce it to the coffee and allow the water to dry back out.
Really?
Yeah, and so that's essentially a similar process. It takes place in, there's a coffee that we buy that's decaffeinated in Mexico called the Mountain Water Process, which is a similar idea. You know, it's run through filters like that. So
are there like decaffeinators all over the world doing this stuff? And they're not just in Mexico and Vancouver, are they?
No, there's a few in Germany, and I don't know exactly where. They're all over the world, but it's quite an intensive process, so they tend to be kind of big plants.
Right, gotcha. There's well,
there was an article in National Geographic not too long ago that showed like some of the decaf dregs that come, like the byproduct of decaffeination is pretty interesting. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see that.
It's interesting.
They must give it to Kenyan runners or something. I don't know. And we have another caller on the line. Welcome to Labor Radio.
Hi, I had a question about coffee quality. I'm not really much of a connoisseur, but I enjoy a good cup now and again. What distinguishes a $5 per pound coffee from a $9 per pound coffee? I know, you know, if it's bitter, I tend to not really care for that, but I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thank you for calling Labor Radio. Go ahead, Joel.
Well, $5 a pound versus $9 a pound, what distinguishes that, I guess, is, ultimately, I guess what you would be referring to is what price was paid for that coffee. But aside from price, I guess cup quality is, it can be a subjective thing, but generally speaking, people tend to agree on what is a quality flavor, you know. A lot of what you're looking for is kind of a lack of defect, which... You know, the first two things you would look for is it clean and is it sweet? Coffee should have a natural sweetness that doesn't come from hazelnut syrup. It comes from the fact that there's a lot of natural sugars in a coffee bean. And so if it's clean, it means it was processed correctly. If it's sweet, it means it was picked at the right time of ripeness. And that's kind of stuff that takes place before we get it. So that's part of sourcing out green coffee. But then... At that point, you have roasting, which is kind of, that's what I do. And you hopefully develop the coffee in a way that it doesn't pick up a harsh bitterness. And so there's as many opinions on coffee roasting as there are coffee roasting companies. So, you know, I won't belabor that point too much. But we tend to roast to a roast level that fully develops the coffee and sort of caramelizes the sugars. But we don't go too far into the roast to where you're starting to taste kind of what I would describe as a roastiness. Or a smoky kind of carbony taste.
Now, but do you think that flavor is reflected in price? I mean, what's the highest amount that your company has paid for per pound for beans?
We actually set the record in Panama in a competition called Best of Panama for a very special coffee that's a geisha variety, very unique variety of coffee that came from Ethiopia, was brought to Panama in the 1940s, huge bean, and it tasted like bergamot, which they used to scent Earl Grey tea,
right,
or tangerine. It was crazy. It almost tasted like non-coffee. And I think we paid somewhere between $21 and $24 a pound green for that.
Wow.
And we didn't buy very much of it, of course, but we just sold it around Christmas time and just tried to show people, like, this is a really unique coffee and make a great half-pound Christmas present.
Did it probably sold out, too?
Yeah, it blew out in a couple weekends. I couldn't believe it. I was very surprised, actually.
I'm not. This is town is coffee crazy. I'll tell you, the interesting thing for me is that I read recently that in Italy there are 200,000 coffee bars. And having been there a few years ago, I found it really interesting the way that the Italians have adopted coffee in their culture. Because I was in Florence. I was outside of Florence in a little bar in a town, and it was everybody from businessmen to the working class in their jeans, you know, and their work boots and hard hats, and they're all standing shoulder to shoulder on this bar, drinking this very small cup of coffee by U.S. standards, a very small, but great stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And I just thought they have a great way of, you know, it seems like different cultures have a different appreciation for coffee. And I wonder what you think about what's happening in America. What's happening in Portland? Do you think people are developing that affinity?
Yeah, I think Portland is actually kind of, the Northwest in general has a very sophisticated palate, and I grew up in the Midwest. I'm kind of a Midwestern boy. I haven't lived there for quite some time, but I'm always amazed at, you know, people's sophistication with whether it's food and wine and beer and coffee, but it's really ingrained in the culture here for everything, you know, quality of life in general, and I sure appreciate that, and that's one of the reasons I'm here.
Well, Colombian coffee in the Midwest is called U-Ban.
Yeah. Well, that, you know,
it comes in a can.
That was discussed, actually, in Colombia, is why Colombian coffee tastes very kind of normal to a lot of people is because that's what they know of coffee. It's just like the higher quality Colombian coffees that you taste are a lot sweeter and cleaner, but it's that profile of just really kind of caramely and nutty and toffee-like. But
so getting back to the fair trade thing, you do sell fair trade coffee at Stumptown, correct?
Yeah, we sure do.
You do. And just because it doesn't say fair trade doesn't mean that you haven't paid these people a good price for this stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of, we've tried to approach this problem, which the problem is the severely depressed commodities market for trading coffee. So
are coffee prices at an all-time low or what?
They're at a historical low, and they have been for a long time. And
how can that be with you know, Starbucks out there selling, you know, and here's a fact from Starbucks. Their last quarter, they had net revenues of $1.9 billion for 3 months.
Yeah. Right? But I think part of it is just kind of a supply and demand thing. There was a huge infusion of sort of lower coffee quality into the market, but you know, I don't really know why. I don't really even understand, or am I even that interested in the New York Stock
right.
Exchange?
So probably all those new trees coming in.
Yeah, basically, we're just trying to sort of be able to buy on quality and buy coffee from people that we know, and sort of remove that buying procedure from the New York Stock Exchange and kind of leave that out of it.
So, how much does your company roast in a year?
Boy, that is a question I don't really have an answer for right now.
A lot, though.
We've seen some growth. We started out as a very small company, and now we're right. kind of a bigger small company. But when I meet people all the time who are in the coffee industry, and we're still kind of a small company, but we certainly have experienced some growth. But one thing that we've actually enjoyed from that is with a little bit of growth, we've actually been able to put our money where our mouth is and pay for quality. When we were a young company, we were buying small amounts of coffee, and you know, money was very tight for us. We weren't able to sort of put the money into the product like that. And so we've been able to grow the business in that way too, which is kind of nice.
And your workers, they're a happy lot? They seem happy every time I go in.
It seems to be,
maybe
it's, yeah.
Is it the free coffee, or is it, you know, or is it because they're getting treated well?
I think people are happy that work at Stumptown. You know, we've sort of managed to create kind of a family atmosphere, and it's a fun place to work, and it's a fun product to kind of play with, and it's, you know, it's a good thing.
Great. Now, one last question. What is Joel Pollack's favorite kind of coffee?
Okay. Well, I have two favorites, but I it changes a lot. I love coffee from all over the world. My two favorites, one is from Brazil, and it was the second place winner in the Cup of Excellence. It's called Fazenda São Benedito. And the other favorite that I have is from Bolivia, and it's from the Siana Cooperative. And I think it took third place, or actually maybe fourth place, in the Cup of Excellence. And just really special coffees, very dense and sweet, incredibly clean, but just massive sweetness and sort of fruity, chocolatey spice flavor. Really incredible.
Interesting. And a dark or a light roast? Explain the dark or light roast, too, because I'm confused about that, too.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the dark and the light roast?
Well, the best way to communicate about roasting for me is there's a period in the roast where the coffee cracks. There's little pockets of air inside the coffee.
Uh-huh.
There's one in the middle called the first crack, and there's one at the end called the second crack. Well, right at the second crack is right around where most people would say this coffee is roasted. It's a light roast, but it's roasted.
Uh-huh.
You can go a little bit before that, and you'll have what's called kind of a city roast, or a little bit farther, right around the second crack, which is called full city, although not everyone calls it that everywhere, so it's kind of confusing. So you go farther into things like Viennese, which is a little bit of roastiness and some oil comes out, and then things like French and Italian, which is a very deep, dark, ebony, kind of shiny, fluffy-looking coffee, which tastes very, very smoky and carbony, which may have a little bit of sweetness left over in it, but generally you're tasting a lot of roast. So for these special coffees,
you're tasting the roast rather than the coffee. In a darker coffee, you're tasting more roast than coffee.
Yeah, really you are.
Really?
Yeah. And for me, that taste doesn't change whether it's from Bolivia or Rwanda or Kenya. So I tend to like coffees that are roasted a little lighter to kind of shine the light on the coffee. So I really want to find out what's going on inside the coffee based on, you know, like I said before, where it's grown, how it's processed, what the variety is. And so for these coffees I just referred to, we roast them kind of right up to the second crack, maybe just a little bit into it.
Interesting.
And they're really clean coffees. And when they're special and clean like that, they can take a really light roast and just be amazing.
Now, one last question. Sumatra, you know, we had the big tidal wave that hit, you know, the tsunami that hit down in Sumatra. And my wife, who loves Sumatran coffee, said she didn't see, it seemed like the quality went down there for a while. Was that a problem?
It was difficult to get good coffee out. The coffee farms are at higher elevations, so that wasn't really affected. But as we all know, the infrastructure, it was just destroyed. So, it was important to get that coffee to market because, I mean, the country was in shambles and they needed the money. But, yeah, B, it was a big challenge. Prices went up just based on transportation costs, and there was a little bit more competition for that coffee just based on kind of the hearsay.
Is that right?
Yeah. We were able to lock in and get some coffees. We had to pay a little more money for it, and that was okay.
So what's coming up here? What kind of great coffees are about to be coming out?
Well, I just visited. I got back from a visit to Honduras, and Steven, my friend who I work with, got back from Nicaragua, and Dwayne just got back from Rwanda. And these are all kind of projects that we're working on. There'll be an auction in Honduras soon and an auction in Nicaragua after that. And we're also waiting on some auction coffee from Colombia, where I visited and was a judge. So we've got some new coffees coming in from these auctions that I'm pretty excited about.
And how will you be able to tell that when you come to your store to pick this up?
You just look at the chalkboards. We don't have a whole lot of like table tents or anything
check
like that.
Check the chalkboard.
Yeah, you can just kind of ask the people behind the counter and the baristas about the coffee, and they're very knowledgeable. I try to cup, and the other roasters, we try to cup few times a week with all of the staff and just get on the same page about what's happening with the coffee and just spread the word, you know, by word of mouth with each other.
Well, Joel Pollack, thanks for joining us on Labor Radio. I think people are excited here. We learned about where this stuff comes from that we rely on. And I'm just going to let everybody know that we're sitting in the studio drinking water right now. a little too late in the day for me to drink coffee. But thanks for joining us on Labor Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I think there's probably another hour's worth of questions left here, and sometime we'll have it back to answer those.
All right.
Thanks.
I like a big one, like Sumatra, like Colombian roast too. It really drives me crazy what your friends would do. Coffee in the morning before I get out of bed.
Coffee, coffee, I like my coffee.
I like my coffee in the morning because those so
thanks,
good.
Buddy.
Yeah.
That was
sweet.
It really doesn't matter if I do get home real late.
Late, late, I get up late.
It really doesn't matter if I do get home real late.
Late, late, I get up late.
As long as you and I have our date before 8.
Washington, you can find their CD called Coming to You at CD Baby. Great little band. And joining me now in the studio, we're shifting from coffee to food, and we're going to talk about a great thing that happened this past Saturday here. Well, actually not here in Portland, but all over the country. The Letter Carriers Union, the one I belong to, had their annual food drive this past Saturday, and the president of the local here in Portland. L.C. Hansen, another K-Brew programmer, is here to share with us the good news. L.C., welcome to Labor Radio.
Hey, this is the first to get to be on with you, Kev.
This is hot.
Yeah, Casey. Okay, so what do you want to know first?
First, let's talk a little bit about the food drive. Where did this, how did we get this thing going? Do you know a little bit about the
Yes,
history?
I do. It was originally piloted in Eugene, Oregon, for the United States of America. It was over 20 years ago. They started doing this community food drive. They've somehow finagled the post office into allowing the letter carriers to pick up food from the mailboxes. They kept raving on about what a great deal it was. So finally, the National got the idea and said, okay, our National Union will sponsor this as a national idea, but first we got to have a pilot project. So guess where 14 years ago we moved to a big kind of local Northwest Union. Would it be Portland, Oregon?
It would be Portland.
Yeah.
Cutting edge.
So 14 years ago, we piloted this, and we are now, after 3 years, it was accepted as a national project, and we're now into our 11th year. We just completed our 11th year of the National Letter Carriers Union Food Drive. It's the largest one in the United States of America. Over 10,000 cities do it on the same day. It's in Guam, in Puerto Rico. It's in the Virgin Islands. It's really extensive and large. In Portland and the surrounding areas, it's the largest food drive. In Oregon, it's the largest food drive of the year, period. We are going to bring in probably 1.3 million pounds. We're a little bit, you know, it's still dribbling in. We haven't weighed it all out, but I think that that's what we're going to come in with from the state of Oregon in one day, and that is a that's a lot larger than that container of coffee you were just talking about, you know, with the,
quite a bit.
I mean, that sounded big with the 120, 50 pound bags right. and the kilos and all that. But when you're looking at this warehouse, it's this huge, massive, like football fields worth of warehouse that's empty in the morning and full at night. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah. If you haven't been to the Oregon Food Bank, to their new location, you should really go check it out because it's a marvel for this community. So if you're a postal customer out there, and who isn't, you probably saw a little card come in your mailbox earlier this week, and then you saw this. You saw this plastic bag come in there, which is another interesting story. Another, let's talk about how we end up with people putting bags in mailboxes.
Well, the cards. I'm going to first say something about those cards. Those cards are a national. National gig. Campbell's Soup comes in as a way to donate money. The post office delivers them for free, and United Way helps fund it. A whole bunch of people fund this postcard. And the postcard is national, goes to every house in the United States of America that's a residence right. delivered to by city carriers. It also comes out in Spanish. That's new this last couple years. And you'll see, if you were a letter carrier, you would know that there's a box of these Spanish cards available to you. And in places like Hillsborough or Woodburn, you know that the folks speak Spanish, so you go ahead and drop a Spanish card on
cool.
them, too. So we're a lot more inclusive than we used to be. The bags, though... The bags are city and town and area specific because they're expensive. To hustle these bags, 1 year it was $16,000 to $20,000 for 1.3 million plastic bags to be produced, printed and produced. And they come in a big truck and
right.
they're really heavy and there's really a lot of them. And then, we work virtually all year on the food bank. I started the food drive planning session, I would say, in early fall last year, probably 8 months before the drive. We take a few months off after the drive. They do the Blues Festival, Oregon Food Bank does the Blues Festival, does some other stuff, and then in fall we start planning again. One of our primary concerns is getting these bags. When we did not have bags about 7-8 years ago, we did not get anywhere near the amount of food. It literally triples the amount because people, it's so easy. They just take the bag, they put the food, they put it on their mailbox. Before that, you know, you're doing good, but
right.
it's harder to remember. Fred Meyer has been working with us the last few years to produce these bags. We want to work with union companies. You know, it's cool to have non-union grocers give us the bags, but we'd really rather have a union company. So UFCW 555 was instrumental in helping bring Fred Meyer into donating these bags free and clear once a year as part of their yearly budget. I don't want to be too wonky, but, you know, fiscal years end in fall, and so you start making all these plans in fall for how you're going to get the various donations you need to get it rolling by the time March comes around. You're in full-fledged meeting mode. By April, we're nuts. And, you know, the last 2 weeks before the production, don't call the union office unless you really have something important.
And today, everybody's arm is sore.
Oh, everybody was dead yesterday. They were dead. You should have seen those people. Every year I go out there, either ride on the back-tailed gate of a pickup truck of my buddy Baxter or drive around myself picking up food for the guys who have the really tough routes. You know that route, Kevin.
Right, right.
You know the one. 20 right. sections, 10 miles right. long, a million stairs.
Right.
You need some help.
Yep. But it's kind of cool. What I like about the food drive is that, granted, it started off with my union of letter carriers with help from the post office. The food bank moved in, became a major player. But if you look at the bag, we have the firefighters, Northwest Oregon Labor Council, the carpenters, the SEIU. It's really just
AFSCME. I got to do a shout out to AFSCME.
Yeah.
1 year we lost, before we got Fred Meyer on for the bags, 1 year we lost the bags,
right.
And AFSCME kicked in $20,000 and bought us the bags on a last minute. We owe AFSCME forever. AFSCME rocks.
Outstanding.
And there's a bunch of other people, too, who give. We've got the machinists. We've got a whole list of folks. I mean, even sometimes some insurance companies that deal with unions, the Columbia Pacific Building and Construction Trades Council, a whole bunch of different firefighters, the Public Employees Union, the Laborers Union, ILWU, we've got the Joint Council of Teamsters, we've got woodworkers, we've got Council of Laborers from Wyoming even, ton of machinists, the lodges, various mounted lodges, plumbers, steam fitters, bricklayers, allied crafts workers. I mean, that's a long list.
It's a huge work.
And those are all people who give us money, and we use that money to try to buy airtime. You remember that old thing called a public service announcement? Remember
how it used to have on?
Yeah, it used to be free for the public.
Right.
Yeah, but now you got to pay money for those.
Unbelievable.
Or hustle. And we use the money donated by the various wonderful, wonderful fellow unionists to buy that money.
Awesome. So we got about 1.3 million pounds.
Yes.
This is just for the Portland metropolitan area.
No, that's for the state of Oregon.
That is for the state of
Portland
Oregon.
Portland metro area. I've got the figures for you. Ta-ta! Last year, day of the event, that is Saturday night before we shut it down at about 9 o'clock, we had 544,586 pounds of food. And this year, same time, same place, we had 560,742 pounds. How can we know by the pound, you may ask?
Because we load it into trucks and we weigh them.
And we have a competition. And we track every single post office and every single zip code. What? Hey, I want to do one last thing. I know we got to wind up.
Okay.
I just want to say Jim Cook, the previous union prez, he really organized this thing, made that partnership with the food bank. Karen Carlson, Jerry Fitzsimmons, Kelly Pindell, absolutely couldn't do it without people who just work all the time to make this happen.
Thank you, LC. And I just want to say one thing, a point of privilege here. The labor movement and the progressive movement in Oregon lost a great activist just the other day, Cornelia Murphy, the political director for AFSCME statewide, passed away. And I just want to say that, Corny, you know, you taught a lot of us how to keep our humor up, how to keep active when we're the long days of campaigns. And, you know, we're going to carry that with us. Your legacy will not be lost. Thank you for listening to Labor Radio.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Ironworkers, Shopmen's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743. And also by SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
Coming to you when I feel the fire. Coming to you when I feel the need. Coming to you when I'm feeling angry, baby. Coming to you when...
stay, where my mind and senses